to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead here again to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, we are at a point now where we are coming out of March, the month that last year changed everything, and making our way into April. I mean, it has been quite a month when you think about everything that has gone on within the last month, and everything, of course, that has gone on within the last year. I think that it's important for us, as we're kind of talking through this, to spend some time situating March, to open up the phone lines, to talk about the month that was. I'm thinking a lot today about self-care, and I want you to think about that as well. This week, as we are struggling through the Derek Chauvin trial, as we are being met with previously never seen video footage of George Floyd walking around the store, this is before he gave the $20 bill, of what happened when the clerk, the worker at the desk, called and told his owner about the $20 bill. We saw that. We saw George Floyd as he hugged friends. He was dancing a little bit. He was laughing and enjoying himself. Nothing unusual when you think about it, except you stop and think what you're looking at are the last few moments of a person's life. I think it's interesting because when I was watching that footage, and I am watching the footage so you don't have to. I would argue that we need to practice some self-care. I know I've been saying this. I want to say it again. Black folks, if we have never practiced self-care before, now is the time to practice self-care. Because these are the moments that will break us. These are the moments that will call into question everything that is happening. These moments here are the moments when you begin to wonder exactly what is happening in this country, and you begin to wonder, how do we go forward from here? We need to practice some self-care. I've made a promise to myself that I will not go back and watch the murder of George Floyd again. I'm not going to do it. I watched it one time last year, and that was enough for me. I mean, how many times do I have to traumatize myself before I recognize that the country is racist and white supremacist, and that the police officers need to have a real serious reckoning with what it means to work with the public? What does it mean to protect and serve and not to herd and police, right? So I said I'm not going to go and watch that. I refuse to go back and rewatch any of the videos from the trial. I'm going to watch them one time so I can talk about them on the air, but I'm not going back. Every single person just about who's been on that stand has broken down and cried. I mean, they all need to see someone. I mean, when you talk about mass therapy for witnesses, they witness the most high-profile murder in this country in a very long time. I want us to think about that. The last time that we as a community had this type of trauma, I'm going to argue, wasn't with Mike Brown. Hear me out. I don't think it was. We led to Ferguson, so we did have kind of wide-scale responses. But I don't think it was Mike Brown. I don't even think it was Eric Garner, even though that was rough to watch. The I can't breathe, the baton around the neck. I would say we go back to when Mamie Till made the decision to keep Emmett Till's coffin open. Seeing the face of Emmett Till that had been pummeled and abused and tortured, a little boy, by two grown white men just because he supposedly, they had heard that he whistled at a white woman, which, by the way, later she said it was a lie. Let's be clear. She said it was a lie and she never was held accountable. I don't care how old she is. She should still serve some time in jail. When Mamie Till, I'm going to say she's a much stronger sister than I am. I want to be very clear. I mean, I like to believe that I'm strong, but to say leave his coffin open, I want the world to see what they did to my son. Like, that takes an incredible amount of strength, because his body was just, it was painful. I mean, you know, I saw that picture because it was on the front cover of Jet magazine. This is why Black press is so important. This is why Black radio is so important. This is why Black newspapers, I'm thinking about the Afro, is so important. Ebony, Essence, Jet, it's so important. Jet magazine put that picture on the cover of the magazine, and it went around the world. When you talk about the type of trauma that people felt within our community, I would say that right there, Emmett Till, I would say it's number one. I would. And I'm not ranking traumas, but I think that one there. You know, but my producer, Justina, has put in another one. She says, you know what? When you think about that picture, seeing the photograph of Emmett Till in that coffin, a baby boy, it is right up there with the photograph with Dr. King. Now, Dr. King, the more famous photograph is not actually Dr. King. But if I were to ask you, you would probably talk about the photograph of everyone pointing across the street towards where the shot came from. That photograph was the one that's been frequently used. But Dr. King, when we think about Dr. King, which is interesting, because I went and I did some, you know, unofficial research on this. I asked people, you know, when they think about Dr. King, what comes to mind? Again, just unofficial, anecdotal research. I'm not writing the paper on it. I didn't do a wide-scale study. It's not verifiable. It's not generalizable. Terms of Dre, as a doctoral student, he knows what I'm talking about. Not that kind of stuff. I just ask people, when you think about Dr. King, what comes to mind? People said, I have a dream. They said, you know, Montgomery bus boycott. They said, letters from Birmingham jail. They said, Dr. King and his speeches. Dr. King and the Poor People's Campaign. Like, when they thought about Dr. King, if you notice, all the memories and images were about Dr. King at the height of his life. Then I asked him, hey, when you think about Emmett Till, what do you think about? Being murdered, being tortured, that photograph. That's what comes to mind. Why? Because Emmett Till was a child. So we don't have a body of work of Emmett Till. George Floyd was someone whose name we did not know except for what happened in that moment. So if I asked you about George Floyd, you're not going to say, well, you know, he was a football player. He liked, you know, this. He did this. He was there. You don't know anything about him except that moment, that traumatic video that has been making its way through social media again, not 8 minutes and 46 seconds, but 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Because of that, I'm saying, Black folks, we got to talk about recovery from trauma. I mentioned yesterday about the allostatic racial load. If you were not with us, there is a term, the allostatic load, by McEwen and Stellar, that came out in 1983, that talks about the what happens to your body when you are exposed to prolonged stress, that your body has a wear and tear on it that begins to break your system down from the inside, right? And so that wear and tear, we're not talking about the wear and tear that happens as you get older, because there's a wear and tear. I mean, I'm at a certain age now, though I'm not as old as maybe y'all think I am. But I mean, sometimes I get up and I'm like, oh, my body takes a minute to get up with me, right? I'm at that moment as someone who's had two babies. Sometimes I gotta take a second to settle myself before I start moving. I have parents whose bodies are starting to, you know, give out on them, right? not that wear and tear that happens even if you've been a runner or a gymnast, or if you've, you know, stuffed yourself on Twinkies and crab cakes. In either case, that's a physical wear and tear. That's not the allostatic load. The allostatic load is about what happens internally, what happens to your blood pressure, what happens to, you know, your mental capacity, what happens to, you know, your digestive system. The allostatic load is all about the wear and tear that takes place inside of you, that then manifests itself in what you do physically, right? And what you do when you are, you know, talking things emotionally, right? It happens when you start to think about things from a psychological perspective. The allostatic load impacts those areas and then gets manifested through the points that I have made. I'm saying that there is an allostatic racial load. There's something about being Black in this country that adds an additional level of stress on Black people. Now, you're wondering, well, you know, you just talked about this yesterday. Why are we back to the allostatic racial load again? Well, I'm back here because we're now on day four, of the Derek Chauvin trial. And every step of the way, like, it physically hurts. I mean, I was physically hurting when I read the testimony of a 9-year-old child. It was hard not to cry when you hear the broken down voice of the young sister who videotaped the murder of George Floyd. She's walking along with her cousin, thinking about her night, hanging out, having fun, and she comes upon a man being tortured and killed. It was hard not to feel anger and frustration when they were cross-examining the professional wrestler. And he was saying, look, you know, I saw what I saw. I said what I said. And yes, I was angry, but you're not going to paint me as an angry Black man because I'm responding to what was happening in that moment. It was physically difficult to watch. And then yesterday, to listen to the testimony of the person who was the last point of contact before the police arrived. The young brother said that he was working that day and that before George Floyd came in, this is his testimony, he said a friend of George Floyd had come in and tried to pass a counterfeit $20 bill. George Floyd's friend. He said he told that person no. Now, at this particular store, the owner has informed the workers that if you accept a counterfeit bill, I'm going to dock it out your pay. I mean, we talk about the mechanisms of capitalism in this country and the ways in which we further oppress people who are economically challenged. I think we've got to really delve deep into that evil that Dr. King talked about, the evil of capitalism, materialism. Like, it's something about being told, look, you know, if you're working, if you accept the counterfeit bill, which means you have to be savvy enough, wise enough, skilled enough to be able to spot a counterfeit 20. When it's being given to you in a heat of the moment. And if you accept it, then I'm going to take it out of your paycheck. The young brother said that he knew it was counterfeit. He said, I could tell it was a blue imprint. Now, even that part of it, I'm like, well, how did you know from just sight only? Usually I've seen people use the magic marker, hold it up. He said he could just tell immediately it was a counterfeit, right? But then he made the decision to accept the bill. And he said, I was going to just take it and I was going to take the hit. He made the decision to accept the bill, but then he informed the owner. And the owner sent him outside. The owner didn't go themselves. The owner sent him outside. Hey, go tell that guy to come back in here. Go get Floyd and bring him back in here. Now, I don't know about you, but if I leave a store and a store worker comes out and says, look, the owner wants you to come back inside, I'm going to honestly say that I'm not going to go. Hey, tell the owner to come out here. Why do I have to get out of my car and come back inside. Tell the owner to come out here. If the owner needs to speak to me, then the owner needs to get up. The fat cat needs to get up and come out here and talk to me. I mean, that's just where I am. So I understand that George Floyd said, no, I'm not coming back in. So the guy goes back inside. And then the store owner sends him out again. Go out again and tell him to come back inside. Now, in this situation for me, I'd start getting angry. Like, why are you back at my car? I probably would have driven off. Like, that's just me. I'm out of here. I don't know what you want, but I'm gone. And at that point, while the brothers outside trying to persuade Floyd, along with some other workers, to come back inside, according to the brother, the owner had someone call the cops, another worker. So everybody's involved in this. And so the video of the young brother who was testifying yesterday, he's walking around outside. He has his hands up on his head. He's like, you know, he was just feeling frustrated, angry. And here's another word he kept saying, I felt guilty. I just felt guilty. When I talk about radical black self-care, this is one of those moments. Like, we got to, you know, get crab cakes. We got to go into resurrection weekend. I mean, like, we got to take a couple of moments because this is hard. This trial is hard. The EMT showing up and saying she's on the stand, she's near tears, saying that she begged Chauvin and she begged the other cops. By the way, all of them should be on trial for murder. But she begged them, please let me help him. And they said no. They said absolutely not. I think we're at a point here when we talk about what it means to be black in America. When we talk about the difficulties with being a part of this country, we got to figure out what that means for us. And I want to use James Baldwin's words today to guide our discussion. James Baldwin in The Fire Next Time in 1963 wrote a letter to his nephew. And he said, and I'm quoting here, "You were born where you were born and faced the future that you faced because you were black and for no other reason. The limits of your ambition were thus expected to be set forever. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity in as many ways as possible that you were a worthless human being. You were not expected to aspire to excellence, you were expected to make peace with mediocrity." James Baldwin tells his nephew that the world does not expect you to be anything. The world does not expect you to have goals and dreams and desires. The world does not expect you to grow beyond their limitations for you. You're expected to make peace with being mediocre. That's what you're expected to do. And you've got to find a way to fight through that. He goes on a couple of years later, 1969, he's on Dick Cavett doing an interview. And James Baldwin says, "If any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, word for word, he is judged a criminal and treated like one. And everything possible is done to make an example of this bad N-I-G-G-R so there won't be any more like him." James Baldwin saying, look, we can't stand up and say, give me liberty, give me death. We can't stand up and say, you know, I have the right to freedom, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We can't stand up and say, no, I don't have to come back in the store just because you want me to come back in. We can't have a bad day in America. Why? Because when we do, we are judged a criminal and treated like one. And if you don't believe it, I just call your attention to George Floyd with Derek Chauvin being judge, juror, and executioner. I want to read this last quote from James Baldwin, and I got a clip from James Baldwin that I want to, the Dick Cavett one, because in 1969, he goes on with Dick Cavett to say, the police are a real menace to every black cat alive in this country. And no matter how many people say you're being paranoid when you talk about police brutality, I know what I'm talking about. For me, this has always been a violent country. It has never been a democracy. 1969, James Baldwin talking about police brutality. 2021, we're talking about police brutality, which is why we got to abolish the police. Let me play this James Baldwin clip for your edification.
Well, what I was discussing was not that problem, really. I was discussing the difficulties, the obstacles, the very real danger of death thrown up by the society when a Negro, when a black man attempts to become a man.
All this emphasis upon black men and white does emphasize something which is here, but it emphasizes it, or perhaps exaggerates it, and therefore makes us put people together in groups which they ought not to be in. I have more in common with a black scholar than I have with a white man who's against scholarship. And you have more in common with a white author than you have with someone who's against all literature. So why must we always concentrate on color or on religion or this? There are other ways of connecting men.
I'll tell you this. When I left this country in 1948, I left this country with one reason only, one reason. I didn't care where I went. I might have gone to Hong Kong. I might have gone to Timbuktu. I ended up in Paris, on the streets of Paris, with $40 in my pocket, on the theory that nothing worse could happen to me there than it already happened to me here. You talk about making it as a writer by yourself. You had to be able then to turn up all the antenna with which you live, because once you turn your back on this society, you may die. You may die. And it's very hard to sit at a typewriter and concentrate on that if you're afraid of the world around you. The years I lived in Paris did one thing for me. They released me from that particular social terror, which was not the paranoia of my own mind, but a real social danger visible in the face of every cop, every boss, everybody. I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, it's the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal for me about a Christian nation. It means that I can't afford to trust most white Christians, and certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto. I don't know if the Board of Education hates black people, but I know the textbooks they give my children to read and the schools that we have to go to. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
Which I have never seen. That was James Baldwin talking about police brutality in 1969. It's 2021. We're talking about police brutality. I just think that nothing has changed. So we're going to talk about that, open up the phone lines, hear from you when we return. Today with Dr. K, I'm Dr. K Wise Whitehead. We're talking today about how we have come so far and yet we have so far to go. We are drawing parallels between some of the things that James Baldwin said about police brutality back in 1969 and 1963 with the reality of where we are here in 2021. I know that I've gotten on this new bandwagon around abolish the police. I just, every single day, I am becoming more convinced that the only way to radically change this country is to burn it down and build it back again. And I don't mean literally burn it down, but for folks in Minneapolis right now, that might be what it means. Because in Minneapolis at this moment, they have a thing called Locks for Lost Lives. Hear me out. And I'll go to your calls, 410-319-8888. Teachers and community activists, young people, college students are now chaining themselves to the 645,000 temporary fence that's outside the courthouse. See, in Minneapolis, where they're trying Derek Chauvin, they've set up some things in place just in case this goes left, just in case there is no justice again in this country. So prior to the trial getting started, the city of Minneapolis put up $645,000. They have a fence that completely encloses the courthouse. Jury is sequestered. They brought in the National Guard. They're there with rifles, and they are out patrolling. And so what people are doing is they're coming up to the fence and they're putting padlocks on the fence and they're chaining themselves to the fence. What they're talking about, locks, L-O-C-K-S, locks for lost lives. Activists have installed several padlocks. And so they put the names of people who've been killed by police on the padlock and they snap them to the fence. They're putting up ribbons and artwork. So they have them up. Good trouble for justice is what they're calling. Should make you think. Good trouble. They have them up, and then at night, the cops come, and they use bolt cutters and cut up all the padlocks and take them down. That's fine, because the activists show up in the morning, and they're putting up new padlocks, and even more people are chaining themselves to the fence. Here is where I want to talk today. What are you willing to sacrifice to be free? Because that's what it's coming down to. Power concedes nothing without a struggle, right? Frederick Douglass told us, it never has, it never will. That the only way that we can be free in this country, if we're talking about true freedom, we're talking about true equity, we're talking about true justice, we're talking about being able to walk and not be afraid, we're talking about not having the police ride our back or even kill us with impunity, be judge, jury, and executioner out in the street. Are you willing to chain yourself to a fence for justice? Are you willing to be arrested for justice? Are you willing to die for justice? Because this space we're living in now, with our increased allostatic racial load, this ain't healthy. Like, it's not. This is not sustainable. I never thought we would be able to sustain this level of interest past Trayvon Martin. I just couldn't believe that we could continue in this very tense-filled state until my father reminded me that the Civil Rights Movement didn't take a year. By the time they got Brown v. Board and the decision in 1954, they had already been protesting for almost 40 years. And when they got Brown v. Board in 1954, it still took them in the modern civil rights movement to take to the streets to force state-level governments, city officials, to respect and to enforce the law that had come down with the interpretation of legalized segregation from the United States Supreme Court. 54 is when you had Brown v. Board. I'm sorry. We didn't march on Washington until 63. We went to my letters from Birmingham Jail, the Birmingham Children's Campaign. We had, 64 was the Civil Rights Act, 65 was the Voting Rights Act. King was assassinated in 68. I mean, people will argue that the modern civil rights movement did not end until 1972 with the Colored People's March in Washington, D.C. I mean, you're talking 54 if you want to go modern civil rights movement and mark Brown v. Board as the beginning of the kind of second civil rights movement to 72. So if that's the case, then we're just getting started with the Black Lives Matter movement. We're just getting started. If we mark it 2014. It's 2021. We got a long way to go. How are we going to be able to sustain this? 410-319-8888. See, Carlisle Van Thompson, 410-319-8888. I have Dave on the phone from Abingdon. Dave, how are you?
Dr. K, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
I have two firsts for you. Yes. Number one, I challenge your listeners to send in $50 a couple weeks ago?
Yes.
And I'm having trouble hearing you, so if I'm talking too loud, please forgive me.
No, you're doing well. Thank you very much.
Okay. I will uphold my side of it. Time's gotten away from me the last 2 weeks, so next week I will be sending a check.
Thank you.
All right, but what I need is an address.
Okay, and I'm going to have you hold on, and we can give you that address.
And I have another.
I'm
really confused about, and I don't mean, you and I have talked a few times, and I think you know I'm not a racist.
I know that, yeah, but what I gather, you're not.
Can you or any of your listeners name the last eight or the last three children killed this past week throughout this country by criminals in the cities?
The last three children killed by criminals?
Yes.
Now, I think that there's an operative word there that I think we can agree on, right?
What's
the operative
that?
Word that you just said is you said criminal, right?
All right, I'll say alleged.
No. I'm glad you said that, because when we think criminal and we think nefarious behavior, then we're not surprised. I think people get concerned because, unlike criminals, police officers are not supposed to shoot and kill unarmed people.
I totally agree.
So, I mean, when I think about the last three children, you know what I am automatically thinking about? Is the big thing that happened where the child got shot with four people, that mass shooting, because whenever four people are shot, you know, by the same person and they're not all in the same family, it's a mass shooting. There was a child part of that. So I'm very concerned about that. But when I look at criminals, I see criminals different than when I look at police officers.
I do not agree. And, you know, I saw the same video as everyone else. Mm-hmm. And if he's guilty, he's going to be guilty. And it's up to the jury. Same was the O.J. Simpson trial. Mm-hmm. Criminal jury found him not guilty. Maybe I have it back. No, civil trial found him guilty.
Yes.
You know, but my point is, I'm trying not to de-emphasize the fact that what that policeman did was totally wrong. But what about the concern about all these children who are being shot in our nation's cities?
Mm. Now, let me ask you this, just as a question, Dave.
Yeah.
So now, when you walk, just walking, are you walking and chewing gum at the same time? Are you walking and having a conversation at the same time? Are you driving and listening to the radio at the same time? I say that because all of these are associative activities. You're a former teacher. You know what I'm talking about. You can do more than one thing at one time.
Right.
Just like we can do those activities, we actually can have conversations about more than one thing. So on this show, we don't just talk about police officers killing unarmed people, but we're in the middle of the Chauvin trial. We can also pivot and talk about what's happening with COVID-19. We can also pivot, as we did just last Thursday, and talk about the wage pay gap. We can pivot on Friday. We talked about, you know, the Second Amendment. So we pivot on this show, as you know. We're just on day four of the Chauvin trial. That's why we're drilling down deep, because we are in the middle of watching expert witness testimony, as well as just individuals who were in the vicinity. And we're talking about the trauma involved with even watching the trial.
Totally agree with you. I do not argue with you at all on that. Mm-hmm. And I hope your listeners understand that.
Yeah, no, they know you, Dave. You gave the challenge. But I think what you're adding is a good point. Because it's like, well, in a two-hour period, what exactly do we look at? And I will say, and I really appreciate, don't hang up, because Justina has to give you the address.
Yeah.
Folks, when we do the show, Justina and I go through probably tons of articles. I mean, she gives me a script that's about 60 pages. And we know that in 2 hours, we're not going to get to that. And so I spend time with Justina first thing in the morning, and we talk throughout the day saying, you know, what story, just to give people a little background here, what story has legs? Like, what's going to be the story that'll get people calling so I'm not talking to you for 2 hours? We're in the midst of the Chauvin trial. That's the story that has legs now. That's why we're drilling down deep on that story. Malik's on the phone. He's a new caller from Baltimore. Malik, how are you?
I'm good. And yourself?
I'm doing well. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm calling. I lived in Minneapolis for 20 years.
Oh, thank
you. From Baltimore.
Yes.
Back in Baltimore.
Welcome back.
George Floyd was murdered in the Fifth Precinct with his notorious for brutalizing black people. I got locked up and lost my license for jaywalking, locked up for spitting on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine just got almost a $2 million settlement for walking through an alley, which is illegal in Minneapolis. Walking through an alley is illegal. And they let the dogs go on them and tore his Achilles out. He caught an infection, almost died.
Wow.
That's the kind of stuff. If you run from the police or just move, one guy running from police got down on his knees when the police got there. He beat his brains in. Old ladies were hollering, screaming. All kinds. That's what goes on up there. And the commissioner, black or white, he's black. He know what's happening. You know, so that's my statement.
I appreciate you calling, Malik, and I'm glad you're back in Baltimore. In talking about the ways in which the Minneapolis Police Department, their particular behavior, what is interesting is that Minneapolis is a place that, where there's a contentious relationship between the police and the black community, that there's a contentious relationship, that this is not new. This is not a place that's trying to make any changes. Minneapolis is a contentious place. The Minneapolis police and black communities have had decades of tension. There's been an ongoing fight against police brutality in Minneapolis for years. I mean, we all know the name George Floyd, but you may also remember the name Philando Castile. Philando Castile was shot by a police officer while being pulled over during a traffic stop. Remember Philando Castile? We talked a lot about that case on this show. The Minnesota police officer who drew widespread protest after he shot and killed Philando Castile, who was charged with second-degree manslaughter, was found not guilty. It took the jurors 27 hours of deliberation, and then they found Geronimo Yanez not guilty. Not just of second-degree manslaughter. They found him not guilty of a dangerous discharge of a firearm. That shooting back in 2016 captured nationwide attention. Let me remind you about it. Philando Castile's fiance, Diamond Reynolds, she live-streamed the aftermath on Facebook. You want to talk about trauma. The image was haunting. It was grisly. It was just disturbing watching the video of Philando Castile, his body bloodied, slumped over. And Reynolds is saying, "He killed my boyfriend." She said that the police officer had opened fire when Castile, Philando Castile, reached for his driver's license. Now, she says that Philando said, told the police officer, "Look, I have a firearm in the car. It is legally registered. I am reaching for my wallet." And the officer shot him in the arm. We have mentioned the name Philando Castile on this show before. How about Christopher Burns, a black man? Christopher Burns was strangled when two officers used a chokehold on him. Jamar Clark, a black man who was shot by the police who responded to a paramedic call. Police officers probably should not be called when there is any kind of psychological breaks with people. We've seen that up in New York. We're talking about Minnesota now. Cops should not be called. Jamar Clark, 24-year-old black man. It was an altercation between two white police officers. He ended up dead, shot and killed. See, it's unclear in this case exactly what happened, but I do know that they released volumes of evidence, including video. They argued that the two officers believed, and you know this quote if you watch any television, that their lives were in danger. One of the cops, Ringenberg, told Schwartz, the other cop, to open fire. So I'm saying we were dealing with that, and that was in 2015. Decades of tension between police officers and black folks in Minnesota across the board, and when you drill down in Minneapolis as well. 410-319-8888, what are you willing to sacrifice? I mean, I want to honestly ask you that. Are you willing to chain yourself to a fence, which is what they're doing right now in Minneapolis? Are you willing to go to jail, which is what they're going to start doing? Mark me on my words. They're going to start arresting people, because that's always the next step. They did it every time we have a movement in this country. They end up arresting people. Are you willing to die? 410-319-8888. Carlisle's a new caller from New York. Carlisle was on the Facebook page, so thank you so much for calling in.
Greetings, doctor. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for joining us.
I'm a professor at Meg Evans College in New York.
Yes, yes.
And I want to, in light of what you're saying, just remind us that when Meg Evans was driving into his driveway, his children and wife heard him, and they were rushing to him, see him, when he was shot down in his driveway. Imagine the trauma that they experienced.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to mention is there's a book by Judith Herman called Trauma and Recovery that we need to look at, because it deals with the whole healing around trauma. And hopefully we can use that text in part of our healing process.
Well, let me ask you this, Prof. How do we heal from this? Given that it hasn't stopped, I mean, you mentioned Medgar Evers. I talked Emmett Till, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. We're talking Philando Castile. Now we're talking George Floyd, and we can easily add more names to that. How do we heal when it's still happening? And it's even more intense now, because unlike the shooting of Medgar Evers that we all heard about, we actually can watch the killing in real time now. Are you with us, Professor Carlisle?
Yes.
So how do we heal from this?
There's no easy answers, as you know. But I think we need to limit our exposure to these incidents because, as you say, we do more damage to ourselves by constantly looking at these things.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of a rough road that we're talking about in terms of trying to get through this. I mean, I know that, you know, in the work that you do up at Meg Evers College, I know you've been up there, I think, I believe, for 19 years or so.
25 years.
Yes, you've been there a while. You know Meg Evers College. But the thing I wonder, you know, kind of with your long eye of history, how do we help people, particularly young people, as a professor, how do we help young people to understand that the way things are now are not the way they're supposed to be, even though it's been like this, or it feels like forever?
That's another excellent question. And the answer is we cannot accept this as normal behavior. We cannot accept this as normal behavior. We have to constantly empower ourselves, write, educate ourselves, study, so we can teach our children, so we can limit these types of incidents as possible, as much as possible.
Trying to find a way to get around it. Okay, thank you so much, sir. I appreciate you calling.
So, thank you.
It's interesting, because I wonder. And 410-319-8888. I wonder, though, how do we limit ourselves and bear witness? Because part of the reason why we were able to see the outpouring of funding towards Black Lives Matter organizations, let's not be fooled, Black Lives Matter Global Foundation picked up, you know, cool $90 million last year after the murder of George Floyd. We saw everyone from Nike to the NFL talking about we need to give it up and deal with Black Lives Matter. You saw an increase in DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion work that everyone's talking about. You saw babynames.com running the names of unarmed black folks who've been killed. Everybody was talking about Black Lives Matter because of the video of George Floyd being killed. without a video, without that video being shared across the world, nobody would be talking about George Floyd, right? So many family members, when there was momentum around trying to get justice for George Floyd, there were a number of family members that reached out to say, you know, well, how about my son? And how about my sister? And hey, let's talk about Breonna Taylor, you know? So I think it's interesting for us to think about how we can move forward. How do we bear witness? We got to figure out a way to get beyond that. And maybe, baby, as we think about the full totality of what it means to be Black in America, and just coming off the trial for a moment, I want to talk a little bit about how it is that it's 2021 in the midst of what's happening with us in this country, and we're still trying to figure out what to call ourselves. I think I got to talk about that. Now, it was told to me just over the last day that we need to call ourselves something different. I just want to run this by you. That within our community and within the indigenous community and within the Hispanic community, there's a discussion that's taken place that we should call ourselves by a different name. That as Black people, and I went all the way back, you know, we had N-I-G-G-E-R on the table. We had N-I-G-G-A, the reclamation of that word, on the table. We had African Americans on the table back in the 1850s. If you go back and you look at the editorials from the newspapers back in the 1850s, you had educated Black folks debating about what we should call ourselves. African Americans was on the table. American Africans was on the table. There were also a couple of editorials about calling ourselves people of the darker hue, calling ourselves sunburnt people. Yeah, that was on the table as well. We have been called colored in this country. We've been called Negro in this country. We started being called Black. We went to Afro-American, went to African-American. And then some of us started using BIPOC, okay? That was kind of the new thing. BIPOC was the new terminology. It's only been out about a year, right? It's already been rejected. BIPOC, which stands for Black and Indigenous People of Color. And BIPOC is the new thing. I mean, you saw it making its way around Twitter, social media, showing up in articles, because they said BIPOC includes all Black people, includes all Indigenous people, includes everybody who falls under a person of color. It's supposed to be BIPOC, B-I-N-P-O-C. We're no longer using that. People of color is the one that I've tried to adopt. I mean, I've been trying to adopt that we are people of color. I'm a woman of color. Now, people of color has now been rejected, right? Because they're saying that that's not broad enough. Now, what's interesting, as I put a little pin here just for a second, we've been using people of color. People who are not of color have been using colored people. Now, we know that if someone calls me colored, that's very different from saying I'm a woman of color. The problem with POC, and somebody was writing about this, the problem with POC is that it centers whiteness as being beyond race. Look at this. It centers whiteness as an attempt to be an affirming identity label for non-white people. That the label, the terminology, people of color, perpetuates the pernicious idea that whiteness is the default and white people therefore have no particular race. That race itself is a special identity marker that is only assigned to people who are, quote, not white, people who are, quote, the other. Because white folks don't have to go under a banner. It's people of color and white people. So I started using people not of color because I'm like, well, why is it that whiteness is centered? So people have been rejecting people of color. Instead, The new terminology, and I want to lay this out and see what you think, is for black people, indigenous people, Hispanic people, people from the continent, whether you're from Kenya, South Africa, Senegal, people from Brazil, people from down, you know, in all parts of South America, from the Caribbean, that we now call ourselves people of the global majority. We're no longer black. We're no longer a person of color. We're no longer BIPOC. We are people of the global majority. And by calling ourselves people of the global majority, it connects us to a larger realm of people outside this country. That as long as we call ourselves the minority community, or the marginalized community, or the community of color, or that we're black, that our history is tied to racial oppression in the United States. So I want to come back. I want to ask you about being people of the global majority. We'll talk about that and so much more when we return.